Well, it's nice to see so many of you here this rather damp morning. And we come to the end of another year with much to be grateful for, but not quite prepared for the great leap into the next century. At the present time, we are being shown, as never before in the history of humanity, what is necessary and why. Unfortunately, however, much of this information is being neglected. It's being ignored, while thousands and millions of human beings attempt to do business as usual. We therefore feel that it is important to conceive and consider the problem of religion in the next century. In the 19th century, it accomplished some good, but a great deal of misunderstanding, and we have continually confused religion with theology. They are not the same thing. They are not even intimately related. Theology is a concept of systems. Theologies are systems of worship, but they do not necessarily have any foundation in the philosophy of religion. Religion is a large term to include all human beings as essentially descended from one spiritual source. Theological thinking is different. It is still concerned with the great number of human beings, but they believe theologically in a competition of sources. Each one feels that it alone originated in the divine experience. They continue centuries after century to compete for which is the holiest among them. And this competition has not only disturbed the religious world, but has done much to contribute to the miseries of our political and industrial systems. We are very largely divided in our convictions about the realities of things. And unless something is done to overcome this division, we will never be able to cooperate in a new world order of thinking. As a result of being ordained to the ministry in 1922, I think I have a fair experience of what is happening and what has happened in the theological sphere. We are still massively divided. We are still attempting to convert each other from one sect to another. Each group believes firmly that it has the direct wire with the infinite. And in addition to these group assignments, we have major world religions which are in conflict and are continuing to emphasize the infallibility of their own beliefs above all other convictions of human beings. This, in a way, is very silly. I remember in the Juvenile Masjid at Delhi, the great Muslim mosque, an attendant of the mosque took me through the buildings. And he spoke English and was therefore considered to be a proper guide. As we were leaving, he turned to me with a smile and he said, "You know, I don't believe that Muhammad could get in here." Everything was tied up in beliefs, tied up in sanctions, sanctified statements, sanctified not by truth, but by the authority of a descent of hierarchical personalities. It is the same everywhere. And the sad part of it all is that there is and can be only one religion. There never has been but one. And it is the evolution of this one that has given the impression of manyness. We are still worshiping the same as our remote ancestors with their totems and with their ancient witchcraft. It is simply that religion has grown up through the believers until today it has ascended about as far as a divided acceptance can take it. We are not a different believer from the Greeks or the Romans. We have simply added or unfolded the theology of that time and created the theology of this time. The problem that we are faced with is to find the religion of the future, to find where we must go from here to make religion work in our world. Religion is essentially man's inward conviction of the reality of a divine power. Religion affirms that the final and ultimate authority for existence is a divine power. Now, to some, this power is a being, to some, it is a principle, to some, it is a law, and to some, it is a mystical experience. But in every case, we affirm that the evolution of the world is real, and that this evolution is the unfolding of a divine principle through all the avenues and attitudes and paths of human life. This religious unfoldment includes art, music, literature, economics, philosophy, politics, everything. It is all one reality growing up in an unbelieving world. Now, as long as nature will control these things, as long as the human being didn't exist, nature went along living its own rules. It never broke its own laws. It never attempted to. It simply unfolded its principles and its policies according to a pattern or principle resting in a divine power. When the human being came along, he was appointed as a gardener in this great world of human and superhuman achievements. He was supposed to take care of this garden and to bestow upon the law an understanding of the purpose of it, so that the flowers and plants and trees that grew would gradually come to know why they grew, and how they grew, and how they could prevent their own growth. Gradually, mankind took over. But instead of seeking in the laws of nature for the solution to natural problems, he sought within human competition for the answers to problems which that competition could not bestow. So we have today a world with several great religions, most of them essentially morally good. There's a little chapel, or used to be, whether it's there now I don't know, on the side of the Mount of Olives in Jerusalem. I went there, and in that little chapel were the Ten Commandments on tablets in many different languages, all essentially the same. The virtues of one faith are the virtues of all faiths. The religion philosophies are all part of one teaching. And it is impossible to divide the truths of spiritual reality without, in a sense, tearing apart the single and simple garment of reality. We are all part of one great purpose, and nearly every religion recognizes this purpose, recognizes a divine principle at the source of life, and that this principle finally will and must be obeyed. Now, as materialism developed in society, the individual began to strengthen his own ego and weaken the universal plan. He decided that he could make history, when in actual history was only his own mistakes. Actually, therefore, instead of unfolding our true inner knowledge of the reality of things, we built a complete physical empire, giving it authority over everything, and declared this physical empire to be truth, reality, and that it contained essential purpose and the fulfillment of principles, and that by means of this great mechanistic structure, we could achieve all things possible to the human being. We have had this concept gradually evolving for the last 300 or 400 years. And in the last 50 years, the concept has begun to fall apart from the obvious fact that it was not true. We have tried to take over the rulership of the universe without understanding the universe or ourselves. We have tried to play God when we had no real understanding of the principles and powers of deity. Therefore, we are in an emergency, and this emergency could be very fatal to us if we do not remedy it in entering into the new century that is at hand. Now, why is it obvious that this change is essential? Why do we feel it's important to make things new before this century comes to an end? The answer is pretty obvious. We have a very short time to make certain corrections in our own behavior, or we will endanger the survival of the planet on which we live. We are capable of destroying ourselves for the first time in recorded history. There has always been a time when we could destroy something. We could destroy a family, a country, a nation, a race. But never before have we been in a position to turn this ball in space into an uninhabitable sphere, something that can no longer support life. Not because this was the original plan, but because human perversity has destroyed the essential foundations of survival. So we are trying to explore all these different areas to find out how we can establish a better foundation upon which to build a future for us all. And I think that we must accept religion as a major factor in this program. It has been a major cause of trouble from the beginning, and it must be able to cause a correction of its own mistakes. It must put straight those things which it itself has made crooked and unreasonable. We therefore say that if we look carefully, we will find that most of the wars that were fought before the beginning of the present century were wars dominated or motivated by religion or justified by it. We have had millions of horrible offenses committed in the name of the love of God. We led the Crusades into the Holy Land to rescue the sacred site of Jerusalem and Nazareth from the infidel. But we never made a crusade to take the infidel out of our own hearts. We remained the same. The Crusades failed utterly, and probably the most terrible and tragic of them all, the Child's Crusade, was when thousands of little children without age or knowledge were sent on this terrible journey to the Holy Land, and most of them died en route. This everything was done possible to perpetuate this terrible feud between beliefs. Now we have come again in this present century to a feud of beliefs. We have just gone through a very heartbreaking experience of persecution on the grounds of religion. After thousands of years, after the fall of the Roman Empire, after the collapse of Greece and Egypt, after the complete failure of medievalism, after the miseries of the Crusades, we are out again on the verge of holy wars. It is unbelievable that we can suffer so much and learn so little. But after all, nature will not permit this condition to go on forever. Either we must change our ways, or day by day we will come closer to the annihilation of all that has been good and proper in our way of life. So with this in mind, we have to say, what are we going to do to help religion to bring about a unification of human purpose? Well, the first thing we must try to do is to get religion to stop dividing humanity, stop actually creating the very discords which are causing the greatest amount of trouble. We are in the presence now of heavy religious influence, which is largely theological. It is a definite battle for competition for the grace of God. And in the name of this grace of God, to conspire leadership in world politics. So what are we going to think about religion? Let us first of all come to the simple conclusion that the mind, in this case, has definitely been the slayer of reality. It is the mind using words in various languages that has accepted names as different and capable of being the source of religious conflict. In other words, God is a perfectly good word, but Allah is the name of a heathen divinity. It is perfectly all right to believe in Jehovah, but not to believe in Brahma. And if we believe in Brahma, we must be saved by those who believe in Jehovah, and those who believe in Jehovah must be saved by those who believe in Brahma. It has never occurred to these people, apparently, that these are words, not gods, and that from the beginning we have given different names to the same thing. And every time a new dimension of deity appears to us, we give it a new name. Therefore, God has become an infinitely growing principle, developing and growing on the basis of human experience in a material world. We've had no time, no energy, and no thought to discover the common ground upon which all of these various beliefs rest. We are worshiping in terms of language. We are worshiping in terms of instruments that were created in the past under other names, but which actually represent the same power and the same principle. There is a master language of comparative religion. If we could understand that and apply it, we would find that the brotherhood of humanity, spiritually speaking, has never actually been damaged except by our own misunderstandings. Therefore, on the night, probably, and we hope, in the 21st century, that man will actually experience the reality of one God, that he will realize that the universe is not made up of various real or unreal deities struggling for rulership. We will come to realize that the actual spirit of God is something that cannot be put into common words if we depend upon language. That is the reason why it is put to music or is experienced in art. It's because in words, we cannot overcome the differences that words imply or infer in our thinking. We therefore worship the names of things, not realizing that these things are one in spite of the diversity of the names. There is only one creating power. There is no anti-power to destroy it. There is no reality that is inconsistent with decency. And there is no escape from the immutability of a divine purpose by which this world was fashioned. The power that created the world, that created the universe, that created all the vast inhabitants of space, the same deity that watches each sparrow's fall, is one power. One tremendous, infinite, creative, and protective benevolence. One unchanging principle of good, existing always for the fulfillment of its own purpose. And all of these creatures are part of the unfoldment of the perfect purpose of the eternal deity. This we can actually accept. It is not necessary for us to change our churches, go somewhere else. We are perfectly entitled to attend such worship as we desire. But let us strive to achieve the realization that the person in the other church is worshiping the same God under another name. We've got to get rid of the mythology of the past in which all the gods in heaven are fighting all the nations of the earth. There are no fighting gods over the cities of today as the deities battled over the walls of Troy. There is only man, the law, and his own misunderstandings. These misunderstandings have been sanctified and justified by actively creating creeds to perpetuate misunderstandings. And to some degree at least, nearly all denominations permit the perpetuation of some type of misunderstanding. They acknowledge and admit differences in basic principles, and these differences are creedal. But these creedal differences have no reality in the presence of truth. So we are going to try some way to create a concept of truth to carry forward into the new century at hand. And among all the problems that we face is the greatest of all, the experience of religious unity. We've got to find some way of discovering that the heavens above us are not at war with themselves as well as with the earth. Now, when we try to achieve this type of unity, I think that probably the best way to approach it is to realize that there are two ways of finding God. That is, there are the ways of worship and the ways of mysticism and revelation. Religion will never be complete for the individual until he perfects it within himself. He cannot find the security that he needs in the world around him or in the teachings of the world around him. We all know, and in my years of experience personally, we know perfectly well that the average person is not really actually living what he says he believes. He claims to believe that he is part of one family, but he is just going through his third divorce. He believes that his children should be brought up right, but they did interfere with his own activities, so he forgets or ignores them. He believes that we should have marriage, so he doesn't marry. All these things we do every day, claiming that there are laws that are real, but these laws interfere with the most important thing that we cling to, and that is the concept of the right to do as we please. The individual believes firmly that he is free to be himself at all times, regardless of the consequences of this freedom upon those around him. In the last analysis, the only individuality of which we are capable, the only freedom that we have, is the freedom of mistake. The reality is there is no freedom. There is no need for it. How can you escape from truth? Why should you want to? The only reason the individual attempts to escape from reality is because he has an unreality of his own that he wishes to cherish. He wishes to do as he please in a world in which he must do as he should or else suffer. We see around us today the infinite consequences of personal selfishness, personal ambition, personal corruption, and we also see that it is leading us inevitably to an end that we do not even want to think about. We thought we had come to the end of it with nuclear fission. Now we realize that there's another end we haven't even guessed at, and that is a possible world conflict in germicides, in plagues, in pestilences, which we can manufacture to destroy each other. This type of thinking should sober somebody. It should represent another step in man's final determination to destroy himself and his world. Now, all of this is not really due to the fact that everybody is bad. It is not due that we are to the fact that some demon is whispering in our ear to contribute to our corruptions. It is simply due to certain basic attitudes which the human being has carried with him since the beginning of his existence, which he has been warned of a million times, but continues to practice at the extent of the common good. These mistakes invariably and inevitably lead to his own misfortune, his own miseries, his own death, but he never realizes that he is the cause of them and the only one who can cure them. In other words, if we wish to survive as a world, we've got to stop the happy, pleasant, self-satisfying way of self-destruction that we are now following. We cannot keep on watching terrible television. We cannot keep on watching all the corruptions of society and learning nothing from them, and under temptation doing the same thing ourselves. The time has come that we've either got to discover a spiritual value in our own natures and do something about it, or we're never going to be able to build this new world that we so gravely hope to find. We have to begin with right now to start a new attitude towards values. Now, what do we really need at the moment? We need what most of the socialist countries are now discovering. They are discovering that without ideals, they are going to go down. Most of the so-called successful communistic states are in desperate trouble. And the only thing that can take them out of trouble is the thing they have denied, a creative idealism and dedication to principle. The principles they tried to dedicate themselves to were so far down on the list of realities that they could not possibly accomplish the end that was desired. Therefore, we now find, actually, on almost all levels, a bankruptcy of materialism. Very closely with it, the bankruptcy of the cause of it, economic profit abuse. All these things are here, they're getting worse, and we've got to do something about them if we wish to hand this planet over to the 21st century with some hope of survival. We also are now building into our lives, into our world, small children who must face this. We may be with them for a while to help them, but the world is going to inherit the substance of our mistakes, and it's about time for them to inherit a legacy of value rather than a legacy of decay and pain. So we're going to do something about our religions. We're going to start in recognizing that each one of us must, in his own way, make his own statement of constructive belief. He has to make this statement to himself, he has to mean it, and he has to live by it. He has to either believe that there is a divine principle of good, or does not believe this. If he does not believe it, he must be willing to face the consequences of that agnostic or atheistic acceptance. What will they be, he may ask. And you can answer him very simply. Look around you and see. The mistakes are already bringing a harvest of pain and misery. They are forcing the change of principles. They are leading away from all of this great social experiment that we have talked about, and are leading back to the fact that the individual, the mother with a small child in her arms, is praying for peace. She does not want to see her child go out and become merely a name on a grave. These things, we can see the mistakes of what we're doing. They're coming in by the million. We can see all of the problems that we have misused. And now we have a nice period of 10-12 years to try to do something about this, to change this policy and make it right, to have some value sense for the future. We've got to begin to recognize the difference between doing as we want to and perishing, or doing as we should and surviving. There's going to be a clear-cut division, and little by little we are building an arsenal that can end survival. And if we use that arsenal, we will not survive. Therefore, we now have a period of a decade or more in which to determine that that arsenal shall never be used, that we will no longer consider this type of solution. We will not believe that we get rid of an enemy by killing him, or that we believe that we will get over a nation by invading it. We will find that all our destructive purposes come back on our heads like blackbirds going under the eaves to roost. We cannot hope to do by evil that which can only be accomplished by good. We also know that religion is the one phase of knowledge that we possess that invites us to contemplate the mysteries of eternity. We have eternal space for science, eternal wealth for economy, eternal power for policy, but we also have eternal mysticism for survival. We have to find our way home. We have to find our roots, and these roots are not in the pocketbooks or the stock exchange. These roots are in the integrities of human nature. Now, where are these integrities? At the moment, their natural repose is to rest quietly in the inner consciousness of man himself. The soul in the human being is the repository of that good which is necessary for the redemption of the personality. In every individual, the soul is the Savior. And the coming of the soul into power is the coming of the world God, the world Savior. So we know that somewhere within each of us there is locked the divine power to redeem ourselves. This power is our redemption. This is our mysterious deity. This is the power that can transform and transmute, that can raise the dead, cast out evil, heal the sick, and nourish and feed the multitudes. It is all in the soul. And it is the annual birth of the soul in this world, so-called, that is the sacrament of Christmas. It is the Christmas principle that each year the soul restates its authority over the body and life of mankind. In other words, Christmas is a symbol of the annual rebirth of the human soul, or of the divine soul, which is the substance of the human soul. Actually, we are therefore always in the presence of our salvation. We do not have to be dipped or sprinkled in order to be baptized. What we actually have to be is touched by the soul within ourselves. It is necessary that at that moment that this transformation be the transformation of the water into wine, the symbol of the dominance or victory of the eternal over the temporal, the victory of eternity over the illusions of time. All of these things are part of a space religion. We are talking about space conquest. It's time to let inner space conquer outer space. And inner space is soul. It is the most mysterious power that animates everything. It is the soul in the planet, in the sun, in the galaxy. It is the soul in man, and in the beast, and in the little plant in the garden. Everywhere there is a power of life struggling to fulfill itself against the ignorance and darkness and selfishness of humanity. There is no principle of evil. There is only man misusing good. The abuse of greatest good is the greatest abuse of all. So in trying to get ready for the next century, there are things we've got to do. One of them is we've got to get spiritual values to children. We've got to find ways of getting over the idea that materialism is the security of child life. The only reason why we're leaving or ignoring religion in the teaching of the young is because it will interfere with the victory of corruption. We do not think of it that way. But we know that if an individual has right principles, he will not be exploited on the basis of temptations to corrupt those principles. Therefore, we need some kind of idealistic teaching to bring to us the security of young people's lives. In many nations, this does exist to some degree. But in the so-called world powers, it is all being sacrificed in terms of profit and defense. And the profit is not certain, and the defense is impossible. Therefore, we are just drifting along nearer and nearer to a day of judgment that we do not really want to face, even though we ignore the problems involved. So we need something for young people. Now, the most natural and proper thing for young people is not that we shall pass a law. This is one of our ways of escaping virtue, is to pass laws. The more laws we pass, the more corruption we have. We should not have a law to teach young people how to live. That is the prime purpose, the glory of parents. It is the small child learning from those whose example it respects, learning to live right from parents who live right. This is the only way it can be done. No matter how much foolishness and corruption and lack of integrity parents may have, there is no social order that can correct this for the young person. The determination lies with the individual. I think Confucius summed it up personally in a very great statement, namely, that no nation is more secure than the integrity of its private families. There is no nation that is stronger than the most corrupt of its social institutions. The need for correction here is very real. Comenius, the great educator of the 17th century, who gave us the public school system, makes definite note that the public school system is a kind of graduate institution to which the child goes for a type of education, having received the basis of integrities in his home before he is 7 years old. Where are these people? The parent doesn't know what to teach. The parent hasn't been taught. The child isn't taught. The child's children will not be taught. And so it will go on until the first line of defense against disintegration disintegrates itself. This is one of the great problems we have to face, that we've got to start with children before they are spoiled, before they are ruined. And we cannot do it by legislation. We cannot put a policeman at the side of the cradle when the child is born. We cannot demand these things from parents whose only interest is in themselves. Therefore, the integrities of this level have to be under religion. They have to be the basic values of faith. Faith being something that changes people for the better. And this is the beginning of the child's growth. And when it goes into school, it has another problem to face. It has the problem of being taught how to live instead of how to die. In school, the child should receive a basic idealistic outlook toward values and the responsibility that that child itself takes in becoming a citizen of its world, of its community. There has to be idealism in school, or there will not be any in life. Now we get to the point, perhaps, where we cannot control this any longer. Perhaps this child is already on its own and breaking the rules of propriety simply on the basic fact that everybody else breaks them. Then we have another problem, that of various therapies and in employment. Employers have a moral responsibility also to measure and protect and integrate the characters of those who work for them. The individual who works for a business, the business itself being dishonest or dishonorable, is simply adding to his own troubles, and that business is adding to its ultimate bankruptcy. So then we get older, and they become more and more mature in thinking. But always the essence is to strengthen the victory of the ideal over the materialistic, to gain a sense of the courage of conscience rather than the fear which leads us all into various corruptions and compromises. So we have this in children, we have it in adults, we have it in jobs, we have it in society, and it comes back at us through entertainment, through literature, through art, and through everything that we know in environment, all of which at the present time is in a miserable state of decadence. All these things we see, but we do not have the strength to do anything about them. We will try to vote for somebody to do it for us. They will get the job and then be convicted a few weeks later for absconding with the funds. There's no answer in this. The answer is, if there's some difficulty at hand, we must do it. We cannot put this on to someone else, because if we do, we will not only get something we can't use, but we will also place another person in jeopardy and let them suffer and perhaps be martyred for principles we should be living every day. So this is not the answer. The answer is very definitely the realization that within ourselves is the power to make realities just as easily as we make disasters. If we have an endless style of doing it wrong, we also have within ourselves the infinite power to do it right. And we must call upon this power more and more. When in doubt, do not try to change society. try to change your own ideals. Get inside of yourself and find out what the lesson is that you should be learning. Not the lesson of how to get out of it and remain the same, but the lesson of how to correct the situation so it will never return. These things we have to face constantly. Now, as we come on with the educational system, we go into all of the arts and practices and education, and we come upon another dimension of religion, one that is very favorable, that's very definite, very useful to us, and that is that religion is the power that will give the person the character to do an 8 hour day's work properly. A religion will cause the individual to realize his moral duty to be true to his job, if it is a good job, and if it isn't, get out of it. But the moral and spiritual value is that it makes him an honest worker, an honest citizen, an honest member of the community, an honest voter when the time comes. But the individual must be under the control or under the direction of his own integrity. Now, how does he find this integrity? Well, most of the mystics have come the hard way. They have found integrity through pain, suffering, privation. They have also found it through martyrdom. The way of the Lord is not easy, but it is easier than what is happening now. And while a little happiness now ends to destruction, a little serious sacrifice in the cause of truth can lead to an infinite fulfillment and protection. The individuals who will work together honorably and honestly may be a little poorer in money, but they will not be among those who do the wailing and gnashing of teeth when things go wrong. Actually, therefore, the reformation of all things lies within ourselves. We must find the facts. Each of us is here with a different problem, but we are in a world in which all problems are handled, and we are here in which there is a solution for our problem. Not only a solution, but a fulfillment of growth, integrity, and peace as a result of outgrowing our own stupidity and ignorance. So we have all these things as part of the challenge of religion. Now, there's no reason, however, that we should do all this the hardest possible way. There are ways in which we can simplify situations so that the pains and miseries of growth are far less acute. One of the simplest things we can start with is to get over the idea that a religion has anything to do with its own name. As one of the great philosophers of the past said, there are 72 names for God, but only one God. We've got to learn that in religious practice, the different sects and groups, the maiden religions and the little splinters, all of them have a spiritual code or conviction. And basically, this conviction is identical in all of them. It changes in wording because of difference in language. It changes in customs because of difference in environments. But it remains the same morally and ethically. It always has been and always will be. There has never been a major religion in the world that taught anything except basic integrities. And then in course and time, these have been compromised. Various theologies become rich in worldly power. They become glorious. They become splendid and try to dominate all the others. But when it gets up to this stage, it's like the rich man who has more trouble getting into heaven than a camel through the eye of a needle, as we've learned from the scripture. Incidentally, there is a needle gate, and it was in Jerusalem. And that gate was so narrow that if a camel went through, it had to take off its load. And that was the moral lesson. The camel could get through, but what it had carrying with it could not.